You're listening to Nowhere to Run with Chris White on the Revelations Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome to Nowhere to Run. My name is Chris. Thank you for downloading the show. Today I thought I would talk a little about health issues and health conspiracies and these kinds of things. I've always been interested in this topic, and I think a lot of you have too. Originally it was stuff like, you know, certain vaccines and all the things that they can cause, and aspartame and fluoride and genetically modified food and all these reasons to eat healthy and all the diseases that are caused by not eating healthy. And I think that's all important and a cause of a whole bunch of stuff. But I think that there's another thing that doesn't get a lot of attention, which I am now even more than ever convinced is one of the primary reasons for not just stuff like obesity and diabetes, but right down to cancer and a host of neurological ailments, probably most of the modern plagues, the new plagues of neurological ailments, including things like schizophrenia, Tourette's syndrome, just things like depression, migraines, neurological stuff like ADHD when it's a real thing as opposed to just sort of misdiagnosed, and a whole lot of other issues that we're going to get into as we progress. But before we do, I want to backtrack a little bit and talk about some of the previous health issues that I've talked about on this podcast and kind of update some of my thinking about that issue before we get into the other stuff. So I have talked a lot about the importance of gluten intolerance and how it can cause a number of things, especially things like leaky gut. That's something otherwise known as intestinal permeability or increased intestinal permeability. And it basically just means that there are microscopic holes in our intestinal lining, which allows everything that we ingest or parts of everything that we ingest to go into our bloodstream and thereby cause all kinds of havoc, because the immune system sees anything in the bloodstream like that, whether it's food particles, medicine particles, whatever. It sees it as an enemy and thereby tries to attack it, eventually causing an overtaxation of the immune system, and ultimately leads to autoimmune diseases. So, but I've often kind of seen leaky gut as sort of the root problem. If you fix that by eating gluten-free and doing certain things to essentially patch up those holes in our intestines, then it will be fixed. But it's really just a symptom of something greater, and I owe this to a lot of research recently that leads to the conclusion that ultimately it's a result of good and bad bacteria, or rather an overgrowth of bad bacteria in the intestines, which leads to all of this stuff, which of course can also lead to malabsorption of vitamins, because most of our vitamin absorption happens in the intestine. I think it's something like 70%. So if it's broken in your intestine, then you're getting malabsorption, which is then causing another host of issues. If you're severely deficient in vitamin B12 or a number of other things that are other vitamins, then you're going to then manifest issues that are essentially a deficiency of vitamins, which your doctor will promptly diagnose as something crazy and give you more drugs that will get into your bloodstream and exacerbate symptoms and all kinds of stuff. But so one of the main ways to fix leaky gut and a host of other issues is to fix the imbalance of good bacteria and bad bacteria in our guts. And this can also be stuff like an overgrowth of yeast and different things in our guts that are causing those holes, but it can also just be the bad bacteria itself. And I think that fixing this is so important, and there's lots of information about this, but first of all, a good probiotic is good. But also, it's important to realize one of the things that's causing bad bacteria is a lack of digestive enzymes. Digestive enzymes are caused or occur when we chew food, and we have a certain amount of digestive enzymes in our saliva, which helps to digest the food. But there was a lot of things back in the day that we used to do that really helped us digest food, including eating a lot of fermented food that we no longer do. Even the foods that used to be fermented no longer go through that process to be produced. And it's really easy and cheap to do this. In fact, one of the easiest and cheapest ways to get a ton of probiotics and a ton of digestive enzymes in the same shot is by making your own homemade sauerkraut, which is just cabbage, which has been left out for a certain amount of time in a particular process. It's not too difficult, but something you want to look up to learn how to do. And it contains a ton of digestive enzymes and a ton of probiotics. If you do it right, it's going to be more probiotics than anything you could get at the store, which is, you know, pretty costly stuff. But I do recommend, if you think that you may be experiencing something, an imbalance of bacteria, which I'm pretty sure most of us are, unless we have been doing really, really well with our diets and stuff like that, then it's a good way to start by finding a supplement of good probiotics. So I want to start off by saying that how important good bacteria and bad bacteria are. If it's something that you may be concerned about, or may you want to look into that. And just a few kind of pointers of things to look for that might indicate that you're having some kind of intestinal issue, whether it be permeability or, you know, good or bad bacteria overgrowth or yeast overgrowth, all of which are essentially the same issue, is first of all, when you eat something, are you noticing any intestinal problems? Some people call this irritable bowel syndrome, but it doesn't even have to get to that level. Just you're noticing intestinal problems a lot, including, you know, gas and bloating and diarrhea and these kinds of things. But also, do you find yourself clearing your throat or coughing a lot after a meal? Or do you notice your spouse or something doing that after a meal or when they do certain things? These are almost certainly indications that you need to deal with this. There are a ton of problems that people are experiencing, whether it's brain fog or all kinds of stuff that's happening as a result of this and our immune systems being overtaxed. But I won't dwell on that because I think we're going to hit most of this stuff as we progress into the main reason I wanted to talk about this. The thing that I want to talk about is regarding some books that I've been reading lately. There are three of them that I would recommend. One is called Grain Brain, Wheat Belly, and Why We Get Fat. These are books that all essentially point to the same issue, and you can get the idea that it is grains are a major problem, especially wheat, but all carbohydrates in general are causing some major issues. And one of the most notable books, even though it's a little bit technical, is Grain Brain. It was written by a neurologist who goes through the science of why gluten and other things are causing free radicals, which are essentially oxidizing all kinds of stuff in a neurological framework. And he goes through all the details about how this is causing things like dementia, ADHD, anxiety, chronic headaches, depression, but goes on to really link this to major issues like schizophrenia and Tourette syndrome, and how he and his neurological practice have seen, you know, countless of these quote-unquote incurable diseases cured when a person essentially abstained from grain products altogether. And one of the telltale signs that he was able to determine is when a person came into his office and had Tourette syndrome or had some kind of odd neurological problem that nobody could diagnose, he tested them for gluten sensitivity. And he makes the point that some of these tests about gluten sensitivity are better than others, and doctors aren't always too keen to do this because it's kind of a new thing. But if you can determine through some of these tests that a person is gluten sensitive, then that's a telltale sign that's probably the core issue. And so when a person would come into his office with one of these things and he tested and they were, you know, extremely gluten sensitive, the person eliminated grains and gluten from their diet, and lo and behold, these incurable diseases went away. Grain Brain by David Perlmutter, MD, is one of the best books if you have a neurological problem or somebody in your family does that you have been told or don't think that there is a solution to. And that can be a host of things, including, you know, I mentioned a few, but seizures and even autism. He doesn't say that autism necessarily is caused by it, but a lot of the things on that are getting diagnosed on the autistic spectrum are listed. And one of the reasons that kids are getting a lot of this stuff is because of a gluten sensitivity problem, oftentimes a result of things like C-sections and so on, which don't give the child the initial amount of good bacteria, which ultimately causes them to be gluten intolerant. And the gluten intolerance is causing the free radicals that are oxidizing the brain. You know, the implications of this are pretty darn severe. So I would encourage you to check it out. It is a technical book. There is a lot of scientific papers and stuff, and talks a lot about, you know, biochemistry. So it's not the easiest read of all the books that I'm going to mention here, but I do want to bring it up first because I think it's the one that has the greatest impact on people that are dealing with this kind of thing. But I will discuss the next book, Wheat Belly, and these are pretty popular books and whatnot. But I before I discuss that, I want to discuss the objection that immediately is raised, and one that I had, which is, how can, you know, grains and gluten and wheat be bad if it's, you know, in the Bible? Jesus says, you know, give us this day our daily bread. He's certainly eating bread, and people have been eating bread for, you know, quite a long time. How can it be bad? And the answer to that is that what we are eating today is nowhere near what they were eating back then. In fact, from the 70s alone, wheat has changed almost totally. And I'll talk a little bit about why that is. But the kind of wheat the ancient people used to eat was a pretty simple kind of wheat. And farmers have always kind of crossbred plants to get, you know, better taste or higher yields and these kinds of things. And not the genetic modification in the way we think about it today with Monsanto or whatever, but just crossbreeding and things like we did with dogs, you know, this with that and see what happens and so on. And that process has been going on and has changed wheat considerably, but really not that big a deal. It was a completely different wheat before the 70s than it was in the ancient times, because of the slow process of farmers crossbreeding different things for various reasons. So it changed a little bit. But in the 70s, a totally new concept was introduced by a particular guy. I can't remember his name. He won the Nobel Prize and whatnot. And his idea was to increase yields, you know, to make it taste better, to make it, you know, all the things that we want. And this isn't genetically modified in the sense that we think of it again. It's just something that he did that basically changed what we know of as like the amber waves of grain, the tall wheat that, you know, was amber and float in the wind and stuff. Doesn't occur anymore. Now we have something that's quite a bit shorter, huge yields. And this doesn't really matter if we're talking about organic whole wheat or anything else. It doesn't work if you say, well, I only eat organic this and that. Well, it's the same stuff. And one of the things that's different about it, and they'd never considered the effect on humans when they did this. It wasn't even a part of their thought process. But it increased, first of all, it's a hugely different genetic makeup, but it increased things like the glycemic index, that is how much it affects your insulin, a huge amount. I think the wheat from back then versus the wheat we have today is like a 30-time different glycemic index. That is to say that it, like, for eating organic whole wheat now is the same kind of glycemic impact that it would be eating a Snickers bar, more than eating a Snickers bar, in fact. So if you're going to eat some organic whole wheat, you might as well, as far as your biochemistry is concerned, you might as well be eating a Snickers or a bunch of sugar. Literally, just straight sugar is better than eating in terms of your glycemic response. So it not only in terms of glycemic response, but it's a totally different genetic makeup, as I said. So I wanted to answer that criticism first. But the book Wheat Belly was pretty good in terms of a good read, although having read these three books on the subject, I do think it limits, it's too limited to just wheat. That's his main sort of focus, but he does a really good job in going through a lot of the science about its impact on diabetes. If you know somebody with diabetes, it is just a travesty what we are doing with what we're telling people with diabetes and how we're telling them to eat a lot of quote-unquote healthy whole grains. And that concept, I'll talk a little bit more with the next book, but the whole idea of how quote-unquote healthy whole grains came to be a term and promoted by the government and everything is just in itself a total ridiculous. And even I think Wheatbelly actually does believe it's kind of a conspiracy, but nevertheless, I think it's probably one of the least complete books in terms of if you really want to know about this issue. I do think that really you kind of need to read all three of these books because they have different, you got to put them all together to really get a full understanding of it, in my opinion. And I think he is too limited on that. But he does show the whole, I mean, and all of them talk about this, the belly fat, what he calls wheat belly, is such an indicative part for, it basically is predicting your death. He shows how it's connected to cancer of the colon and all kinds of various things that he in his practice as a doctor has seen people with just myriad diseases and things that are cured by people going gluten-free. But he's showing how belly fat is essentially indicative of inflammation, causing a lot. It's indicative that your organs are being sort of infiltrated with this. Your heart too is also, but and he's a heart practitioner, if I remember correctly. But your heart is shielded by your rib cage, and so it's not as noticeable. He goes on to point out that this idea of essentially plaque in the heart and all these things are, you know, caused by this. And I'll explain this probably a little better how that works when I talk about the next book, which is probably the book that I would recommend the most in terms of understanding how it all works, and I think is more complete in showing what the problem is, because as I mentioned, I think that limiting this just to wheat is kind of not telling the whole story. Though to his credit, the guy who wrote Wheatbelly is mainly concerned with those things that are caused by gluten sensitivity and the fallout that happens with that. So he's not as concerned about some of the other health issues that are essentially caused by insulin response, which would include not just wheat and grain products, but sugar and basically all carbohydrates. So the next book is probably one of the better ones. And I'm going to talk about the issues with, you know, going low carb and some of the things that people do wrong and how to do it right here in a minute. But this next book called Why We Get Fat was a game changer for me, because I'm the type of person that needs to know why something is happening in order for me to do it. If a doctor tells me to, you know, for example, put, you know, hold a cold compress on it for 3 times a day for an hour, I'm almost certainly not going to do that unless he also explains to me why. Well, if you do that, it actually will cause this thing to happen and whatever. And then I'm like, oh, okay, that makes sense. I'll do that. I don't know. That's just me. Maybe I'm stubborn or whatever. But that's why this book was so important for me, is, you know, how to lose weight was always such a nebulous thing for me. It's like, well, yeah, I know I need to exercise and eat right and whatever. And it just became this sort of burden. And I'm not terribly overweight. I'm probably a good 30 pounds overweight, but I'm a pretty tall guy too, 6'5" or something. So it's not quite as noticeable, but I definitely need to lose some pounds. And I've already lost. I mean, I've been on doing this for about a week and a day or two, and I've lost 10 pounds. So it definitely is significant. But if you know what he's saying, I don't think that at the very least you'll know what to do when you do decide to lose weight, because there's really only one factor. He makes this point brilliantly in the book that, as opposed to the common view that I would have, if you would have asked me before this how I lost weight or anybody lost weight, I would say, well, it's simple. It's how many calories you take in versus how many calories you burn. And that's the only consideration that you need to know. He calls it calories in, calories out. And how that idea came to be, as logical as it may seem, and that's the reason it's prevalent, is because it's logical. And as he shows, it's definitely not because it's been proven in the laboratory. There is no proof of calories in, calories out being true. And that's one of the most brilliant things about this book, is showing that this idea that exercise makes you lose weight is completely refuted in their own studies. I mean, of course, exercise will make you lose weight. He goes through all that stuff of why are marathon runners and, you know, all this stuff. He goes through all this stuff, but it's definitely not because of exercise and eating less calories. In fact, exercise by its very nature will cause you to require more calories. So you're either going to exercise and always be hungry for the rest of your life because you're not getting the energy that you're required to do the exercise. Anyway, I won't go into all that stuff. I'll save that for if you're interested in why calories in and calories out came to be, which is basically one guy very, very recently that had government ties that basically made it the common view, and it was not the earlier view before that. Anyway, I'll leave that for the book. But his basic premise is that we get fat because of insulin response. When you eat something that causes an insulin response, which is basically all carbohydrates. I mean, there's good carbohydrates we'll talk about, like in vegetables and stuff like that. But anything with a high insulin response, like grains and sugar and, you know, anything especially that's easily digestible, like sodas and fruit juices and these kinds of things, the metabolic response due to the insulin is to essentially create fat. And if you want to look at it like this, we get fat because we are fat. So when you drink or eat something that causes a high insulin response, it's going to essentially create the triglycerides, the fat, which in itself is going to cause you to want to eat more because, well, I need to back up here a little bit. Most of us nowadays are burning carbs for energy. That's not how it used to be. It's not how it's supposed to be. When we burn carbs for energy, as opposed to burning fat for energy, the body is predisposed to doing that. And so when you burn the carbs after a meal, you will inevitably get hungry about 2 hours afterwards because the body needs more carbs because it's decided to just burn carbs for energy. And it's storing the rest of the fat as fat as opposed to burning it. So you're basically on this carb-only burning idea as opposed to being what he calls ketogenic, which is what we have been doing for all our lives, is burning fat for energy. But anyway, or not all our lives, but all of humanity's lives. Anyway, and then as you create more fat due to eating carbs and only burning carbs and essentially storing the fat, then it's causing you to need more because your weight is increasing, so your hunger is increasing to deal with the added weight that you're now carrying, and it's a vicious cycle. You're eating when you're not hungry because your body's pushing the buttons for hunger because it's simply run out of carbs, and it's just a terrible thing. So I recommend that book to understand all that stuff in more detail, but it definitely works. And I'll talk a little bit about how to apply this and the benefits of doing it. I've been doing this since I read the first book. That's probably been about a week and a half or something like that. And I've lost 10 pounds, feeling better than ever. And it's just something that definitely works. But here's the issue with this. Low carb and going low carb is sometimes misinterpreted as eating just, you know, meat and cheese and vegetables. When I think that when people do it wrong, that is, they're just eating meat all the time and cheese all the time, it's going to cause other problems, particularly going back to the beginning, which is gut bacteria. The main sort of criticism of this is that you will ultimately get bad gut bacteria because you're just eating meats and not a lot of the things that actually cause good bacteria, which is vegetables and a diversity of vegetables. And I would say primarily vegetables. People don't, they read these kinds of things and they think, oh, that'll be easy. I'll just eat, you know, steak and blue cheese and, all day or whatever. And but I think that the idea is that it needs to be primarily plant-based. And, of course, I'm going to recommend mostly organic everything, organic meats, cheeses, and vegetables, and a variety of vegetables, because we get our enzymes and we get our, you know, the good bacteria and everything else from a good plant-based, diverse diet. So that's the one thing I would say you have to do, is to recognize that it's mostly plant-based. Though you can eat as much as you want of anything and not gain any weight if you're not causing the insulin spike. I mean, there is no calorie counting. You can eat a whole bunch of everything, and, you know, eggs all day and steak all day and with cheese all day, and you're not going to gain weight if there's not an insulin response. I know it sounds counterintuitive, but my point is you got to make sure that you are, number one, drinking a lot of water, and number two, have a primarily plant-based diet, or at least going erring on the side of plants than you would of meat and cheeses and stuff. I think that's where people go wrong. And I also think that to fix this stuff, it's a good thing to go ahead and supplement some probiotics and to be doing that to get everything back on track, especially if you're going to go this route and you've probably had some issues before that. But the way that I think about this now, and he makes the point in Why We Get Fat, is that after this, I know how to lose weight. There is only one thing that matters with weight loss, and it's not exercise. It is insulin response. And, you know, I haven't exercised. He exercises, he mentioned in the book, exercise is great, especially for brain health. And grain, he makes a big point about exercise, but again, he's showing data that shows the different neurological things that happen with exercise and so on. So it's definitely important to exercise. I'm not disparaging exercise, but in terms of losing weight, it's not the main thing. Then you need to know that. But I got to tell you, this is frustrating for me, because if you're listening to these books, then you know somebody with diabetes, or you know somebody with heart problems, or you know somebody with all the neurological problems, whether it's migraine headaches or ADHD or you know, Tourette syndrome or all these different things that people have, it's difficult, because you know after reading these things that's at least might be the answer. I mean, there's other reasons that some of these things can happen. Don't get me wrong, and they go through that in all the books, but you can, like, you know, there's so many people that I know that I need to tell this to, but I know it's a very difficult thing, because the alternative is something that they don't want to hear. They are not going to hear it when I say, you know, you need to cut out the sugars and the grains, especially gluten-containing grains, and it's just not going to go over well. And so it's a difficult thing to talk to people about, but it's frustrating, because basically people are dying because of this simple issue. So the other thing I do want to talk about is gluten-free stuff. I've been going gluten-free for a long time, and I have cut out, you know, sugars and stuff for a long time as well. So it wasn't really that big of a deal for me to do this, though for other people it can be kind of a difficult process, especially early on. To eliminate sugars and stuff. And I thought I'd mention a few things that do help a little bit, especially if you're eliminating sugar. You know, we know a lot of the artificial sweeteners are really bad for you, even worse than any of this stuff. So I would recommend something like stevia. We use something called stevia in the raw. It's basically packaged like sugar, so you can measure it out, you know, if you're making tea or other kinds of goods that require sugar. You can actually, you know, measure a cup of it in the recipes, and it'll be equal to what it would have been if you were adding sugar. But I think stevia is a really good idea. It's not Truvia or whatever. That's not natural, but stevia is. It's a plant that they've been using in the Amazon rainforest to sweeten their tea for, you know, millennia, or maybe hundreds of years is probably more accurate. But anyway, so that's something for sugar. Now, a lot of people there's a lot of good gluten-free alternatives out there. And if your goal is not really to lose weight, well, you will lose weight if you cut out all the sugars and stuff. You're going to lose weight anyway, even if you choose gluten-free options. But the problem with gluten-free options is, if you're trying to lose weight, is that they substitute the wheat and other gluten-containing foods with things like potato starch, tapioca starch, corn starch, all those things. There's only one kind of group of items besides, you know, obvious stuff like sugar and stuff like that, that have a higher glycemic index than wheat, and that is potato starch, tapioca starch, and corn starch. So it's causing a massive insulin response if you're eating gluten-free food. So it's not something that's good for losing weight, but it may be good for you to sort of, if you're having gluten intolerance issues, which especially the neurological stuff or a lot of the other things that he mentions in Wheat Belly that are causing, you know, all kinds of stuff. The gluten-free foods are good. I like the Udi's brand. Udi's makes great pizza. If you have that in your supermarket, you're lucky. A lot of them do these days. And things like pasta, rice pastas and the other gluten-free pastas are just terrible. But I do like, and can't even tell the difference, in quinoa pasta. There's one called, I think, something Harvest. And it's a really great gluten-free pasta using quinoa. And again, those things are great if you have or suspect any gluten intolerance issues, but they are not so good if you're dealing with, or if you want to lose weight. But, so it wasn't that difficult for me going, you know, just eliminating. Basically, the only thing I needed to eliminate now was gluten-free foods, you know, prepackaged gluten-free foods like the gluten-free pizza and pasta. But in addition, a lot of potatoes and corn chips, which is something that I basically was eating quite a lot of, is potato chips and corn chips because, hey, they were gluten-free, you know. So, and again, that's something you might want to do if it's not a weight loss issue that you're worried about. And you want, there's a lot of great stuff. I mean, I look at gluten-free now and think, wow, there's a lot of options in gluten-free. But if you really want to lose the weight, it needs to be all carbs, all grains, all sugars. So, and that leaves you quite a lot. I mean, I love my process now. I mean, I eat for breakfast now, I eat 2 eggs and maybe a half of an avocado. I pack a ton of, like, pre-make a lot of salad. I diversify a lot of the greens and, you know, lots of, you know, can put cheese and dressing and stuff on it, no matter what it is. You don't have to worry about the amounts of salad and stuff you're eating, or really even meats. But anyway, there's a lot of stuff that you can do and with this, and of course any kind of meat. And ironically, it's the meat that has a lot of fat in it that's best for you, saturated fat included. Now, trans fat, of course, is bad. That's the stuff that, like, Crisco and stuff. But saturated fat, these books, all of which will make the case that saturated fat is actually good, not bad. Things like coconut oil is really good for you, not bad for you. It doesn't affect your heart health. It doesn't affect your weight. So it's a totally new revolution in all these things that I want to recommend to you. And all three of these books are available as audiobooks. If you're an audiophile like me and you'd rather listen than read, then you can get them on Audible. If you want to get one of them for free, you can do so by going to my link. I can't remember what it is. audibletrial.com/Chris. And if you sign up for a free trial, you can get one of these books for free. It's totally risk-free. You can cancel at any time, keep the audiobook that you got for free. I did that originally with it. I got my free audiobook and canceled, but I went back because I really liked listening to Audible books. Now I listen to just a ton of Audible books all the time, but that's another story. So you can go to audibletrial.com/Chris if you're interested in getting one of these books for free. But again, they are Grain Brain, Wheat Belly, and Why We Get Fat. So check those out if you're interested in learning more the specifics about these things, which I didn't do so good about telling you about, but at least you get the basic idea. Thanks for listening. If you would like a free copy of the Christianity 101 DVD, which contains 8 gigabytes of audio, video, and text of various discipleship materials on a data DVD, please go to any one of my websites and look for the Christianity 101 button. It's totally free, and I'll ship it to you wherever you are in the world. If you would like to support this ministry or any of the others that I do, please consider a tax-deductible donation,
which can be sent by PayPal using the email chris@chriswhiteministries.com or by clicking the PayPal button on any one of my websites. Another great way to support this ministry is by writing a review of the podcast on iTunes or writing a review of my books on Amazon. Reviews figure very prominently into the ranking algorithms of both of those websites, and the higher they rank, the more people that can be reached. Thanks for your time and for subscribing to this feed.